And this old guy came up to her and said, you know, I voted Republican my entire life. He's like, I have been watching how you respond to people on your Facebook posts, the people that I know, and you're civil and you have good conversations and you're willing to engage in dialogue. I am voting for you. For the first time in my life, I'm voting for you because you're willing to talk.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Sean Kemp is a founder and CEO of Action Sprout, an 18-person company that's been around about 8 years and works to change the way nonprofits and campaigns use Facebook. Sean is very knowledgeable about what Facebook users find engaging and how tools can help manage their engagement on that platform. Sean's background includes working as a group leader at Microsoft and other entrepreneurial activities in both for-profit and nonprofit worlds. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Sean Kemp and Action Sprout.
The way political campaigns are engaging with voters is changing, and DS Political is here to help. Without live events and door-to-door canvassing, campaigns have to get creative. DS Political matches offline voter data to online profiles with match rates up to 90%, allowing you to target your voters with precision. We pioneered the best integration of data and technology to persuade audiences and deliver wins for progressive candidates and causes with efficient and effective programmatic digital advertising campaigns. Learn more at dspolitical.com/battlefield.
Hi, Sean.
Hello.
How are you this morning on the West Coast?
I'm a little worried this morning with all the news that's circulating right now about coronavirus. But other than that, I'm healthy and well and doing good.
Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
Sure, absolutely. I'm Sean Kemp. I am the CEO of a company called Action Sprout. We've actually been around for 8 years. We just celebrated our 8-year anniversary.
So it's a lot longer than most businesses.
It is. I need to stop calling us a startup, I think. That's no longer a thing. And we've been focused on making Facebook work for causes and civic leaders has been kind of always our mission in that space. But that's what I do currently in my professional life. I'm kind of a blend of technologist and experiential designer. That's kind of how I think of myself.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up all over. I actually spent time in Oregon, in Hawaii, in California, and then I'm now in Washington. So kind of the whole West Coast was my stomping ground as a formative youth growing up. But early childhood was a place called Gold Beach, Oregon. And then Kona, Hawaii was where I graduated from high school.
What kind of family? Was it a political family?
They were kind of hippies, I guess would be the way to describe it. I mean, I grew up, you know, in third grade, I was making signs for Save the Whales and joining Greenpeace. That was kind of the family I grew up in. So they were more activist-y. My dad in particular was very much activist. He was ex-Air Force. He was actually military. He was ex-Air Force, but that was before I was born. And kind of rebelled against the whole system. And so we were kind of anti-big government and very much environmental.
Where'd you go off to school?
I actually came to the town I'm in now, in Bellingham, Washington, and it's a university called Western Washington University. It's just a state university here in Washington.
What'd you study there?
I got a degree in industrial design, which if you're not familiar with it, is kind of a combo of marketing, engineering, and art. So industrial designers usually create hard good product like the iPhone or things like that.
It's kind of a background that seems to me more and more useful in the world of sort of startup tech. Having that kind of product and design background is really helpful.
It is. I mean, I think of it as I got an education in problem solving and in human-centered problem solving. How do you take a problem that somebody is facing, understand that problem, and then develop some kind of a solution that solves that problem, but do it in a way that's manufacturable so that it's reproducible so you can scale it.
What did you learn in that program that you might still apply today?
I learned you got to work really, really, really hard. The program was really competitive. There were 36 of us that started it, and only 12 got into the junior and senior years of the program. So we had a pretty brutal cut process. But you really have to think through a problem. It takes a long time to think through something and explore all the different avenues and repercussions that that could have. Because when you have to get poked apart, when you're presenting something and you have 12 really, really bright classmates whose only role during presentations is to pick apart all the things you didn't catch, you learn to think through all the pieces.
Did they teach you any like iterative stuff, or was it all present a finished product and get it critiqued?
You know, that's actually my one criticism of the way they teach that particular thing, and still do in a lot of places, is it is very much about come up with it all in your head and then present a finished product as opposed to iterating on it. I know that's changing in a lot of the curriculum, but that's the one thing that I've learned, especially in the last 10 years being in the startup realm, was untraining myself from that kind of waterfall approach where you design it all up front and then release it to the market.
What was the first thing you did out of college?
So like all my classmates, so Bellingham's a small town. I moved to Seattle and I bought a house and I remodeled it. I was savvy enough in college to realize that if I bought a house and kind of leveraged some stuff, I could have roommates and they would pay for the house. So I lived for free and had enough that I was able to then get another house after I graduated. But at the same time, I started up a digital, basically kind of agency doing digital stuff. At the time, motion graphics were really big. There was a program called Flash that had come out from Adobe that was all about being able to do visual, moving, animated things, especially on the web. I made banners for casinos and advertising, things like that. All the blinking banners at the top of websites at the time, that was what I was doing. And then I did that for about a year until I got recruited to come work at Microsoft on a new project that was codenamed Xbox.
It was codenamed Xbox. Did it end up being called Xbox?
It did, because Microsoft, for all of its innovation, is really terrible at naming products. So it's often that a codename becomes the product name because the team's like, I don't know. I don't have a better idea. We love that codename.
I think Xbox is a pretty good name. I happen to be a person who's never bought a home arcade machine of any sort. Why was Xbox something cool to work on?
At the time, I was a big gamer. I'm not anymore, actually. I actually left that group because I kind of had a crisis of confidence in what we were doing and the effects it was having on especially youth. But at the time, I was a big gamer. I grew up with computers, and the idea of creating games that people could play was intriguing to me, and I really liked what they were doing there. It was a big company that I had a lot of respect for. As an early kid growing up, my dad introduced me to investing. And like in third grade, I would read the Wall Street Journal and chart graphs and things. Microsoft was one of my favorite stocks. Like I bought that stock early in the 80s. And so I had a lot of respect for the company. And I really liked the team. So at the time, there were like 15 people that were on that Xbox project. And they were isolated and they were doing something new. And they kind of had this mandate to kind of break things a little bit, to kind of reinvent Microsoft in that space and see whether they could develop a community of gamers, which was very different from what Microsoft had been known for, which was business applications and operating systems and things like that.
What did you learn from working on that team?
I learned a lot of things I don't do currently, which is you can burn people out. You can work them to the bone and get a lot out of people, but they don't stay. And so you tend to churn a lot of people. But the positive things that I learned from that was community really matters. So when I entered that arena, I was thinking more about design. But I sharpened my skills on building online and digital communities. I was part of the team that ran the .com, the web side of things. And ultimately, when I left, I was running all of the worldwide .com properties for that particular effort. But I had a teammate and I that we were a little bit of troublemakers. We often fought with the legal teams because we wanted to explore the concept of forums and building these really robust digital communities, because we knew gamers liked to interact together. And so we built a web presence that really focused on community and bringing people together. And we just discovered all kinds of really interesting outcomes from that. Like we were able to power the support team with stuff that was coming out of the community, problems that people were having with games. We were able to discover that in the communities. There was hundreds of thousands of people in these communities actively posting, talking about the games. And we were able to actually pull that data out and pre-seed the support teams with answers to questions before they actually hit the support phone lines. And so I really realized the power that connecting people had, both in elevating the product in the marketplace, but also in providing this experience and this deep affinity and support network for those people.
Microsoft's pretty well known for, making people into millionaires that were connected to products that did well. Did you get to participate? Did they give stock? Did they reward you in a way commensurate with their success on that?
I get to put Microsoft on my resume. That's about as much as I got. No, my cohort was interesting. I joined in 99. I think I started and I was there for 6 years. My first day at the company was actually the all-time stock price high, and I left and it had only gone down. So when I left, they had this buyout offer where I think I got $5,000 for my stock. It was all completely underwater. So we did have options invested in grants and things like that.
That's too bad. What made you leave? You said something about a crisis of confidence.
I worked on a couple of different projects at Microsoft. I left the Xbox group because we had successfully moved the needle on 18 to 24 year olds, the amount of time they were spending playing video games. We had moved it from about 12 hours a week to close to 30 hours a week was kind of what we had done. And I mean, we were the number 2 selling game console. I mean, it's amazing what you can do when you have $2 billion to market a product, but a lot of people were using it. And in particular, the stuff we did around Xbox Live. So allowing people to play with people that weren't in the same room as them really upped the amount of time they were spending on it, because they didn't have to leave their houses. They could just play games with people in other countries. I didn't really like that. And at the time, a lot of my friends were starting to have kids and were asking me, or had, kids that were getting older and were asking me, should we get them a game console? What should we do? And my answer was always, I think you should hold off. I think you should wait. I'm a little worried about the addiction properties and just, what it does to them, or, at least control what they have access to. The more I was giving that answer, the more I was like, well, but all I'm doing for my job is selling more of those consoles to more of those kids. And I was starting to feel like it wasn't authentic to who I was. And so I actually left and went to the central marketing group at Microsoft and focused more on the small business, mid-market and enterprise solutions, and did a bunch of work there, and then moved over and ran the digital for the Windows side of things. Windows Vista was actually the product that I left. I quit the company after we shipped that product.
The reason I didn't ever buy a, Nintendo or Xbox or one of these things is because when I was in junior high, I used to go to the arcades in Boulder, in the golden age of arcades, and play whatever stand-up game was there. And I knew that if I had it at home, it would be trouble. So I stayed away from it. So what did you do next after Microsoft?
My wife was actually at Washington Mutual at the time, which was right when Washington Mutual, which was a bank based out of Seattle, collapsed. It was the first of the financial institutions that just disappeared literally overnight. An entire bank that was nationwide was just gone. That had kind of happened in my wife's world, and I was overworked and overstressed at Microsoft. And we just decided we were going to leave. We were going to leave Seattle, quit our jobs, and move to Bellingham, which is about an hour and a half north, which is where we had both gone to college. So we had fond memories of it. And we quit with no plan, pretty much, and just left, seeking something more. We were really seeking, a better, more meaningful life. didn't really know exactly what that was, but knew it had something to do with community and finding a spot that shared our values more. And we really liked this, the community here. The idea was to take a year or two off and just live. And I actually, within 3 weeks, there was a group out of Seattle. At the time, they were called One Northwest. They were a nonprofit that did technology enablement for other nonprofits, primarily in the environmental and sustainability space. They were actually founded by Paul Brainerd, who created PageMaker and sold it to Adobe, and then created the Brainerd Foundation, which funded a lot of nonprofits. But I had been volunteering with them on some web stuff, just helping them understand and strategy, and was pretty good friends with their executive director. And he said, you should come volunteer with us. And within 3 weeks, I was on full-time as a digital strategist, helping them kind of move some of the work that we had done around relationship marketing. We had tried to transform Microsoft to a relationship marketing company the last 2 years I was there. Not very successfully, but the idea of full lifetime value and how do you build those connections and relationships. I brought that into this, and we actually built these things called ladders of engagement, engagement pyramids, and tried to teach the nonprofit sector how to think about building relationships over time, using CRM systems to track and monitor that stuff. Within 3 weeks, my plan to not work had failed, and I was a full-time employee of this nonprofit out of Seattle, working remotely from Bellingham.
That's the problem with having skills. It's hard to be on.
It is.
So how long did you do that?
A little shy of 2 years. And then it actually comes full circle to where I am now. But one of the people there was actually from Portland, a guy named Drew Bernard. And we did a lot of work together on the strategy side. He was kind of in the same boat, had done some entrepreneurial stuff and joined the organization quite a few years before I did. We were talking a lot about the shared economy at the time. And this was before Uber and any of those things. And we both kind of had the desire to get back into the entrepreneurial space. And so we left, and we actually started an asset sharing application that was called ShareZen. And we were focused on the kind of the high value shared asset space. So private planes, houses, boats, things like that, that people actually own in common, and facilitating the sharing of those assets using an online platform to coordinate.
Did it work?
No. it was an abysmal failure. I think we did it for 2 years. It was great. We had, I think at the high point, we had a couple thousand shared aircraft in the system, and a number of vacation homes and boats and things like that. But there was a fatal flaw. So we saw this flaw over and over again in it, which was you would have these really expensive aircrafts, and the idea of paying $10 a month for, which is what we were charging for the software. Right.
They don't want to pay for you. They want to pay for you because it was, this sort of thing should be free, even though they have a $1 million airplane that they want to share. Or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would feel these calls all the time. You know, somebody would be like, oh, we just got our second aircraft. Do you think we can get a discount on our second subscription? And I can see that they just spent $150 on fuel because it's in the system. And that was what we faced over and over again, was this, people didn't want to pay for that particular aspect of the shared economy.
Oh, and there also aren't that many people in that plane sharing part of the economy, right?
No, about 10% of private planes are owned in common. So it's not super small, but no, it's not a huge market.
Yeah. Wasn't there something, Bellport Ventures or something like that?
So at the time, this was about when you started seeing the birth of these startup incubators, Y Combinator, Techstars were all happening. And I was involved a lot in the angel investing community in the Northwest, and had started a couple of different, we actually started something called the Big Idea Lab, which was our own small version of Techstars in the Bellingham area. Drew and I actually, as we were kind of winding down ShareZen, we're trying to figure out what's next. And we created Bellport Ventures, was just more of an incubation effort. It was a holding company where we were playing with a lot of different ideas for what was going to be next, which eventually became the idea that took root and became, was actually the Action Sprout idea.
What did you learn about entrepreneurship in that period of time?
I learned about Agile and why it was so important, especially coaching and mentoring a lot of other startups, that you had to get out and talk to customers, which which I'd always kind of done, but not really in earnest and not really listening, where you're not selling something. I realized in that I was really good at talking people into the idea I had, which doesn't mean they're going to buy it necessarily, but I can get them to be really excited about my idea, which isn't listening. And so how do you get out and actually understand what it is that somebody is dealing with, whether there's a market for it, whether they'll pay for it, in that. And watching a number of ventures fail fast was super enlightening. And we encourage that, the idea of getting out there and realizing as early as possible whether there was a thing for it.
So you said you've been about 8 years into Action Sprout. So that puts us back in the beginning of 2012, it sounds like. What was the seed for the sprout?
Drew and I were actually complaining about, we had just gotten out of a meeting with some nonprofits. We're still doing a lot of work, helping advising nonprofits through some of the One Northwest efforts. And we had just gotten out of this meeting where the nonprofits were so fixated on the idea of fan count. Like, they were spending an inordinate amount of time talking about and trying to figure out how they were going to use Facebook. And you keep in mind, Facebook was there, but it wasn't as big as it is today. And everybody was just so fixated on, well, what's our fan count? How do we grow our fan count? And we really believed it was a vanity metric. It was interesting, but it wasn't going to lead necessarily to outcomes for these nonprofits. So we were complaining about it. And a friend of ours said, God, you guys, you know, this works for businesses. There's ways to harness the power of it. Stop complaining and do something about it. So that was kind of the genesis of it. We're like, all right, you're right. We got to stop complaining. So that was our, like, okay, we think we can do something with this. And we knew enough about what was happening at Facebook to understand that there was an opportunity for us. At the time, we thought it was to be able to do community-based donations. So the idea of pledging, like, I'll give $5 if five of my friends also give $5. Was kind of our going in hypothesis, which didn't work. But it led to the idea of, you know, you can use social platforms, especially Facebook, to engage, connect with people, and move them up the ladder of engagement a little bit. You know, that clicktivism aspect, but it's a starting point. You can actually get them to sign a petition, to send a letter, and then you can move them into an engagement funnel. And so that's kind of where we started building against.
Did you form a company?
We did, actually. It was originally called Pledgematic for about 3 months. And then we realized that the donation aspect, the pledging to donate, was not what people wanted to do. We renamed it to Action Sprout and incorporated.
Why Action Sprout?
The two things. One was around action. We really believed that activating people, and especially causes and nonprofits, being able to really activate and move people to action was important. So that was the action part. And then Sprout was kind of the idea of growing something. How do you start small? How do you plant a seed that then becomes something bigger than what it began with?
Trace for me a little bit the way that the organism that was Action Sprout grew over time, and what some of the key decisions that you made as you built this.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story, as you can imagine, with Facebook over the last 8 years.
Some changes, yeah.
Yeah, and some interesting changes in the world, as we've seen, which we'll probably get to in this storytelling here. The first thing was the premise of, we're going to stay just on Facebook. That was one of the things we revisited every single year, because everybody was always asking us to go cross-platform. You know, how do you tap every social thing that comes out and stay current with all of them? So when the latest thing comes out, you have integrations with that. And so that was one of the decisions we've constantly revisited. And something that's been an interesting part of the growth of the company is we've mostly only stuck to being a Facebook-centric platform, which has had downsides for us, in that we don't support TikTok and Snapchat and Twitter and all those other ones. But we've been able to keep up with and keep our methodology 100% focused on what is now the dominant platform out there for most people.
What did you enable people to do? When someone uses your software, what are they able to make happen?
So today, we have a lot of stuff. I'll give you the list of the stuff we do now, and then I'll kind of walk you back through how we got to that point. So today, we help people find and share better stories. So we help them post content on Facebook. We help them to run ads against those stories. So use Facebook advertising to make sure those stories reach more of the right people. We help them run what we call social actions. So a petition they can sign, or a poll they can complete, or a donation even that they can do. We have a number of different types of those actions. But the idea being, convert people from somebody who follows to somebody who is more engaged and ultimately can be contactable off of Facebook. And then we have stuff around community. So helping them to do things like manage comments, tame the trolls, or connect with a deeper network of people and understand how those people are engaging with them. We currently have a full suite, if you will, of stuff to be more effective at Facebook. But we started with the actions. That was our initial thing, which was we knew that nonprofits and causes were really, really, really focused on growing, in particular, their email lists, the lists of their supporters that they could contact. And so that's where we started, was building those tools to make it easy for people to complete an action on Facebook with a single tap.
And were you tapping into that community that you knew from, was it One Northwest? You had ready clients that you knew needed to do this kind of thing. Who were initial clients for you? How did you serve them?
Yeah. So, our initial clients were a lot of the environmental, especially some of the Northwest ones. So like Sierra Club was one of our first users and clients, and just a bunch of the like environmental, Greenpeace, and even small, like super small ones. And then a number of political candidates actually started using us that first year as well, because they wanted to, again, run actions and do different things. And that first year was actually pretty interesting. So we actually thought that first year we would be about half and half, half on the political side and half on the nonprofit kind of advocacy side. You've probably experienced this because of your past, the stuff that you've done. That first year in November, we lost half of our paid users in one day. As soon as the general election was over, every one of our political users canceled their accounts and deleted everything. And that was a bit of a brutal shock, because our theory was use it year round, not stop using it as soon as you win or lose. And it was kind of a hit to the, at the time we were self-funding it, so we weren't like at break even on revenue, but it was a shock to lose half of our revenue in one day, one night.
It's definitely one of the biggest challenges for entrepreneurs in the politics space, especially if who you found as clients is a lot of challengers, right? Because in most elections, like 90% of the challengers lose. And so if you didn't make inroads among incumbents, it's almost like you didn't build up a base of reference clients to use next time.
Exactly, exactly.
Did the market sort of teach you, hey, this nonprofit space is a little more desirable?
It did. I mean, I would say we were more attracted to it anyways. It was kind of a reinforcing feedback loop of, we're not gonna sell into the political space right away. I mean, that was that we were like, okay, it's not sustainable. We don't want to chase this particular thing because it will lead to decisions that we think will actually harm what we're trying to build for the causes and for the world, really, which was the idea of continual ongoing engagement and community building. We knew if we were focused on selling into political efforts at that time, that we would be kind of focused on these shorter term wins and not on building a system that facilitated that ongoing continual relationship building.
Were the tool needs different between those two markets?
As we've come to realize now, no, they're really the same. The mindset is what's different. So the candidates who use our tools now really effectively use them year round. They're really open about putting out stories, building community, having conversations around those stories, and being part of the digital ecosystem that is their virtual community. It's a manifestation of it, which is exactly the same as what a good nonprofit does or a good influencer does. You're there, you tell stories, you're authentic, and you're part of the conversation. You're part of the party. So it's all the same. The mindset is what's a little different. Nonprofits are so used to having program managers and organizers that are in the community. Most of them actually are, you know, that's what they do. Most nonprofits are actually out in their communities doing the stuff. They're, you know, working in the soup kitchen, serving the food, or they're out, you know, serving foster youth. They're actually doing the things. And so they have that mindset. Whereas in the political space, there's a hesitation to being too open, to being too connected, because they're worried about negative comments and things like that. So they tend to have a harder time using, especially the social media tools on an ongoing basis, because they're afraid. They're afraid of what people will say or do.
It would be my guess that if you have a bunch of clients, that you'd have a few that would use this sort of tool to great success, and that there'd be a lot that disappointed because they didn't have the right person adopting it and really taking advantage of it. What do you see though?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, one of the most common things that we see, and actually the reason we went from actions to content to stories, was the most common feedback, and it still is one of the more common feedback points, is I signed up for ActionSprout, I created this action, and nobody completed it. And you look at it, you're like, yeah, that's because that's all about you and nothing about the people. You didn't tell a story, it's not urgent, it doesn't meet them where they are. And so we do tend to see that. People just expect to come in, find a tool that will get a whole bunch of people to donate without doing the hard work of figuring out what it is that people care about. What is it that you should be talking about?
What's an example of a great success that one of your clients had using your tools to do something interesting?
There's a couple that come to mind. One was actually this group out of, they were on the East Coast, and they did a lot of ocean cleanup type of efforts. They're pollution related to the ocean. They came to one of the trainings that I did, and for a year they had been using ActionSprout to find and share stories and run little petitions and social actions and really just engage their community, build a kind of a robust Facebook following. And it was just it was a small little org. And it was the ED that was doing this. She was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And she would constantly ping me and our support team and ask questions and just kind of learning how to do it. It had built a pretty good little following. Like, and when they started, I think she had like 300 fans or something, and nobody engaged with any posts. And then they launched something called the Cora Ball, which was this thing you can put in your washing machine that captures microfibers when you're washing, so they don't get into the water system. And they launched it on Kickstarter, and they talked to people about it on their Facebook page. Like, they kind of announced it on their Facebook page as the big thing. And I think within the first day, they had met their goal for selling that. She emailed us and said, you know what? This is 100% about the community we built on Facebook. If we hadn't done that, we probably would not have funded this thing as quickly as we did. So it's just neat to hear that. Like, the work that you do over time is the thing that's going to lead you to success when you need it.
And that's got to be gratifying when you have a client do that. What's another example like that?
Yeah, I mean, another one was actually more in the political space. She ran for state ledge in Washington State against an incumbent that was, so she was a Democrat, and the incumbent was a longstanding Republican, rural district here in our area. She really leaned into Facebook as the platform that she was going to use to reach the voters, and especially the rural voters that were part of her district. And she shared a lot of stories. She sourced a lot of stuff. She, you know, managed the comments. She was actually involved in the actual comments a lot, responding to them, moved a bunch of money from flyers to Facebook because she was liking the success that she was seeing there. She actually won against the incumbent, who had deep ties to the rural community. So it was a tough race. But the story that sticks out the best, and I think really paints why it's so effective, is she went to a conservative meeting where the candidates were there. And this old guy came up to her and said, you know, I voted Republican my entire life. He's like, I have been watching how you respond to people on your Facebook posts, the people that I know. And you're civil and you have good conversations and you're willing to engage in dialogue. I am voting for you. For the first time in my life, I'm voting for you because you're willing to talk and you're willing to have constructive dialogue. the work that she had done to put the stories out there and then engage the community resulted in those types of activities happening, bridging the divide and actually having a constructive dialogue with someone who normally probably wouldn't have voted for her.
I think you know that I built a company that sold only to Democrats. Are you partisan or do you take all comers as clients?
As a software company, we are self-service. So anybody can come and sign up and create an account on ActionSprout. The only things that we actually block on are if you're a hate group. So if you're on the Southern Poverty Law Center list or somebody flags you and we deem you to be an actual harm to society, we'll remove your account. In terms of what we've built, both Drew, who's no longer with the company now, and myself and most of the people who are here, all have a progressive mindset. And so what we've built are tools that work really well for people that care about issues like climate change, like affordable housing, like women's reproductive rights, LGBTQ, marriage equality. All of these things work better if you have a progressive leaning on those things. So we've built a tool that is easier and more effective to use if you're a Democrat or progressive leaning than if you're on the other side. So I think that's kind of what we built something that it's hard to not use it for those causes.
In practice, what does that make your client base look like? Among the political clients, what proportion are Democrats and versus Republicans?
I would say we're probably 80% Democrat, 20% Republican. If I look at our signups that come in on the political side, in terms of active users, it's probably more like 100% progressive or liberal Democrat on that side. Again, hard to use. If you're forced to look at a feed and choose between topics, like if you subscribe to our gun control topic, all you're going to see is stuff related to why you should restrict bump stocks and things like that. There's not a lot to do there if you're on the other side of the aisle.
So why not restrict it in that way?
A couple of reasons. One, I think having a bright line is hard, especially a lot of what we serve is, and this was a decision we made early, which was not to chase enterprise accounts. We don't have a sales team at all because we didn't want to go after just the big clients. We really wanted to serve the small organizations, the small efforts that are happening, the grassroots types of stuff. It's hard to draw a line and say you're on this side of the line or you're on this side of the line. For example, we had a candidate who ran for the Public Utility Board. He spent $750 on Facebook and won against a 30-year entrenched incumbent. It's a nonpartisan race, and he considers himself nonpartisan. I would consider him aligned with progressive values, but if I had to restrict it to only one thing, he probably wouldn't fit in that. He wasn't endorsed because he couldn't be endorsed. It was a race that didn't allow that. Same with nonprofits. A lot of like nonprofits that work on, say, like foster care or childhood stuff or even homelessness, they often map to more kind of conservative areas. And so if we had to block it, I wouldn't be able to, Lighthouse or Missions wouldn't be able to use our stuff to help fight homelessness and feed people in their communities, or school boards or PTSAs, ones that actually can't take a thing would be blocked from using it. So it's more about how do we make the world better? How do we get these issues out and teach people how to communicate with people around those issues that matter?
One of the challenges of having a specialized tool like this for a nonprofit or for a campaign is that the nonprofit would typically have a CRM or a main tool or other tools. How do you work in that market? How do you integrate and fit in with other things that your clients use?
And they do. There's a lot of tools out there. It comes back to that decision we've always made to just be Facebook-centric. And so part of that decision has always forced us to think about integrations. If you run social actions in our system, we don't try and recreate a CRM inside of ActionSprout. We simply integrate with those systems. So if you use MailChimp or Constant Contact or Salesforce or Nation Builder or Salsa Labs, we just sync the data to your existing CRM or email systems. If you use Hootsuite or Buffer, when you're in our story feeds, you can share it to Facebook or you can push it to Hootsuite or Buffer so that you can use your social scheduling tools that you already have.
Who do you see as your competition?
Time. there's a lot of other tools out there that people could use. There's other scheduling tools. There's other action tools that you can run petitions. There's other advertising tools that are out there. But in general, what we find is the competition is just people, especially that we serve in the nonprofit and political space. They're just strapped for time. Do they send out an email newsletter or do they post something on Facebook? And so that's kind of what we, so a lot of what we do is design stuff to compete with time, make it easier, make it faster so that they can have their time to do other things with it.
How big is your company now?
In terms of staff, we're at about 18 people in the company now. So it's fairly small and that's purposeful. We like to stay nimble and agile. Facebook kind of forces us to do that, but we want to be able to have the most impact with the least amount of people. And so we don't have a lot of operational overhead in terms of management and things like that. But in terms of impact, we're in 72 countries with users now. I think we're just closing in on about 100,000 nonprofits that are connected, that have ActionSprout connected to their Facebook pages.
That's a huge number.
Yeah. Yeah. which is also why.
I know there's a lot of nonprofits, but 100,000, they can auto sign up and they can go. It's not a heavy touch sales.
Right. And we have one person who runs our support side of things. And she only works 25 hours a week.
So it doesn't need too much hand holding. It's something that people can learn and operate without a lot of tech support.
Yeah. Yeah. That's always been our goal. How do we give something that is easy for somebody to use so that they can figure it out really quickly without having to have a bunch of knowledge?
What's the biggest challenge for you these days?
Facebook.
Why?
I would say two things. I mean, one, 2016 was absolutely brutal for us. If you paid attention to the news at all, Cambridge Analytica, Facebook's response to data, and just people's general trust of that as a platform has been eroded pretty dramatically. One of the most common things is people are just asking, does Facebook even matter? Should we even do anything on Facebook anymore? Which is always an interesting question because if you look at the usage numbers, it hasn't gone down. People are less trusting of it, but they're actually on Facebook even more and they're getting even more of their news and information and building even more of their communities on that platform. And they're not moving to other platforms pretty dramatically. The one that they're moving to is Instagram, but that's Facebook.
Is that true for kids? When I talk to, people my daughter's age, she's in high school, very few of them are on Facebook that I see.
It is true of the younger. So yeah, under 18, you do see a pretty big drop there. But again, under 18 aren't usually the demographic that most nonprofits, causes, or political candidates are going after necessarily. And then under 18, a lot of them are on Instagram, which is essentially the exact same underpinning.
Do you plan to move your tools to Instagram? Or are they already there?
They're mostly there. We have a love-hate relationship with Facebook's APIs that we use because they're not as stable as they could be. So we support like Instagram ads. So when you run an ad through ActionSprout, we also support running that ad on Instagram. So we have support there for that. And then a lot of our people will actually push it to their Instagram feeds as well. So we're thinking about it. It's becoming more and more, we're seeing more and more happening there. So it will probably be the first of our multi-platform things. If we add something, it'll probably be that. But at this point, it's looking more, it's just a slightly different version of Facebook.
You sort of indicated that down ballot politics is of interest to you now. What are you seeing in 2020 as far as people adopting ActionSprout and what are they using it for?
the core premise why we built Action Sprout and what had us intrigued was, how do we actually put the power into the hands of organizations that are at the edges? And so, you know, when I talk a lot about that, it's the nonprofits that are sitting at the local community levels. And when I talk about political candidates, it's those down ballot candidates. It's the people that are mayors, that are city council, county council, or state legislative, because that's where the change really actually happens. And it's also the groups that have the least tools and the least knowledge about how to use those tools. So what gets me excited is actually being able to empower somebody who is running for state ledge or county council to be able to use Facebook effectively in what they're doing. So both telling the stories, being out there. So for example, most political candidates will post on Facebook. About 11% of political candidates post once a day. And about 56% of political candidates post less than once a week. So a little over half. They're not even visible within those areas. And so being able to give them the tools and the strategies and the methodology to build community online, I think is really interesting and powerful. And to that end, we've also done stuff like we've built into our tool all 6,500 state legislative districts for targeting with Facebook ads. That's, you'll only find that in Action Sprout. And we've done that with the House districts and the Senate districts. And we'll probably do that with stuff like precincts and county council as well this cycle.
Do you do that by partnering with providers that have those lists? How are you making that happen?
Yeah, I mean, some of it's public data. So state, House, and Senate stuff is all public shape files. I'm the oldest of six kids, so there's a lot of people in my family. One of my brothers is a geographer, GIS specialist, and so he was able to help point us in the right direction for those. And then in other cases, precincts, stuff like that, we'll work with local groups that have the shape files, and then we'll map those to our system for targeting.
You had earlier mentioned something like 100,000 nonprofits had downloaded it, and I assume that's a fair number of candidates now. What percentage of those do you think are actively using it?
We have about 15% of people who start that keep using it overall, but they'll jump around. So it's a hard one to answer because people tend to move within, especially social media people, tend to move jobs frequently. And so they'll stop using it for one org and then we won't see them for 3 months, and then all of a sudden they'll pop up and they're running another org's Facebook page. We have these weird cycles where we'll lose a bunch of people and then suddenly they'll pop up. And in the political space, it's all over the board. They'll not use it for 6 months and then they're in using it on 8 different accounts.
What are you trying to take this company? Where would you like it to be? Is it something that you would, you know, like to have acquired? Is it something that you want to sort of be a small giant? What would you like to see out of Action Sprout in the long run?
You know, it's interesting because we are a corporation. We're not a nonprofit ourselves, but we are mission oriented. So we've always kept that, you know, and our goal is to make a meaningful impact on the world and to do that by empowering others. So be of service to the communities that are out there. We do have investors and we have a board and we are somewhat profit motivated. The likely long-term outcome is some form of an acquisition, but probably in a space that lets us do more. So where it actually is a 1+1=3 type of scenario. So not just selling to the highest bidder, but where there's actually, where we could merge it with other activities where we actually become more interesting because of the joining of the two different types of things that are happening.
That makes sense. We're facing this pandemic virus right now. If you've been in the nonprofit space since 2012, you've seen several cycles of viruses. Do you have nonprofits that are working in the corona area? What have you seen historically and what are you seeing now?
We actually just launched a coronavirus feed in our story feeds. We were actually a little late to the party because I was having trouble finding partners that were willing to actually put stories into it because everybody didn't know what the actual truth was. But we have. We've done a lot of work over the last couple of years. We had a major initiative that we actually partnered with Facebook, USAID, the Gates Foundation, where we were working on global health, using Facebook data to help inform global health efforts. So it's an interesting thing because when I think about Facebook, I actually think of it less as a platform for distribution and more of a platform for experimentation and listening. And so we used Facebook data to help inform the Pan American Health Organization down in Brazil on how were people talking about the Zika virus that was affecting quite a few people down there. And we were able very quickly, using the data that we saw on stories and posts and comments that people were making, to be able to come back with unique and novel insights into what people actually cared about compared to what they were running campaigns about. Within a week, we were able to have new ideas for approaching it that they hadn't even thought of. And then when they tested those, with $12,000 in Facebook ads, they were able to get a 3-point lift on public perception in Brazil around taking action on the Zika virus. Just unheard of for very little amounts of money. We did the same things around H1N1 and with meningitis in Nigeria and Myanmar. So there's so much that you can do there because they're sharing their very real things with people they care about, with their communities.
Do you ever get confused with the basketball player who has your name? he was a hell of a player. I don't know if you watched him.
He was. I came to Washington for college at the height of his career, the original Sean Kemp.
Because he played the real Sean Seattle Kemp.
The real Sean Kemp. I used to get a lot of his mail, and I would get great seats at restaurants when I would call for reservations. So yeah, but we look very different. I am a 6-foot tall, skinny, redheaded, white guy.
Yeah, and he was 6'10", African American guy. So yeah, There's a slight difference there. Did I see that you also do some art?
I do.
Tell me about that a little bit. I'm always fascinated by that kind of hobby.
Yeah. So I've always been creative. I love a creative outlet, which drives everything that I do. But I find that having some kind of space to be able to create something that's just for me, that other people aren't looking at and judging, and I'm not trying to map it to other people, gives me a kind of a centering where I'm able to refocus my energies. And so I got intrigued a couple of years ago with new technology using lasers to cut things. And so I have a laser in my garage that's capable of cutting wood. And I do these dimensional layered art pieces where I design something and then I do it in 12 to 14 different layers. And so it basically creates this sculpture that can go on the wall that is different things. It's dimensional. It's hard to describe in words, but it's
someone fun. Wanted to see pictures of that work of yours. Is there a place?
I don't have them up online yet. It's kind of you would find them on my personal Facebook page. Actually, I do have a public Facebook page that I am starting to post pictures of those up on. So if you look for Sean Kemp, I have a public verified Facebook page that you can find some of them on.
That's pretty cool. Is there a question that I didn't ask that you wish I had?
We've seen Cambridge Analytica and kind of a transformation of people's perception on Facebook's role and how it's affecting especially politics. Am I worried? I guess would be the question.
Are you worried about sort of the misinformation, disinformation aspect? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, are you?
And the answer,
I mean, you're yeah. intimately embedded in that space, right?
Yeah. And I'm worried about it from two standpoints. One, I do think we've built these tools and platforms that are incredibly effective for people to share information on. And sharing has a double-edged sword. Sharing can be really good at times if it's authentic and meaningful. And it can be really bad if people are sharing stuff that is harmful. It's a great vector for malicious actors to be able to put stuff into. And we've seen this especially in the US elections with foreign interference. And we pick it up in all the signals we monitor. There are concerted, coordinated efforts that are happening to steer and misinform people in the US around different things. So that one really disturbs me.
Is there something we can do about that? Do you do anything? Do you make recommendations to the campaigns and nonprofits about things they can do?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's two things we can do. One, we could legislate it and force the platforms to take it all off, which I don't think will ever happen. And I don't actually think they could do it. The second thing we can do is we could fight misinformation with truth and get a lot louder and be more purposeful about flooding the feeds with authentic, truthful information. And I think it has to happen at the local level. And I'll give you a specific example. There was a candidate who was running for state Senate, and he put out some information to counter some fake information that was happening. And someone commented on it with a bunch of fake information, trying to mislead it. And someone in that community that was not in favor of this particular candidate, it was a Republican, and this candidate was a Democrat, basically countered that person and said, "Hey, who are you? This is a small town. I know all the Republicans. Who are you? I don't know you." And the person disappeared. And it was someone who was an inauthentic actor. It was not a real citizen or real resident of that particular town. So I think you have to have that happen at the local levels. It'll never happen at the national level because everyone's anonymous at the national level.
Is it possible to stop automated accounts across these platforms?
I don't know. I think it's an arms race. I think AI is evolving so rapidly, and a lot of these things that they're not using fully automated, they're using hybrid. I mean, it's easy to spin up 200 people working out of an office park in Russia can influence massive amounts of stuff. Like, it doesn't take a lot of real people to actually sway something. And so all you need is a couple of comments on a post before people start reacting to it.
I know that you're kind of focused on the local races and so on, but when you look at the 2020 presidential from the lens of being an expert on Facebook, do you think that the sides are at all evenly matched, or what are you seeing?
So on Facebook, no, I don't think they're evenly matched. I think, if I look at the presidential race right now, I think Trump's campaign they've got it dialed in on Facebook. Their stuff is really good. They're testing like crazy. They're being agile. They're micro-targeting. They're segmenting. They are using all of the tools at their disposal. And they're willing to go places that I don't think anybody should go, but they are willing to go there in terms of...
What's an example?
Basically misinformation. They're experimenting so broadly that they are pulling in stories that are truly fake. And they're okay with it. Like, they're not worried about it, it doesn't seem like.
No ethics whatsoever.
Yeah. I mean, I hesitate to go there because I don't know the people directly, but... I mean, from what I can see from the outside, I question the ethics involved in the stuff that they're spreading.
Do you have a sense on the Democratic side of who might be leading the efforts and who's doing a good job at countering that at all?
You know, I mean, in terms of like Democrats who are kind of leaning into to Facebook. I mean, I think AOC and her team did a great job at their cycle and are continuing to do fairly well there. Again, she's not running for president, but
a lot of people listen to her.
But a lot of people listen to her. And at a national level, she's doing pretty good. The Sanders team, I think, they're aging a little bit. Like, their stuff's a little dated, but they're still doing fairly good. Like, when I look at the stats that I have access to, Bernie is, I mean, it's Trump and share of voice. And then it's Bernie in terms of share of voice on Facebook. And by share of voice, I mean engagement. So not just reach, but total engagement for the stories that they're sharing through their channels. And they have Bernie has distributed channels. He has a lot of state-based and other groups that are loosely aligned, distributed within that type of thing. And they're sharing lots of meaningful stories that get lots of meaningful engagement to the people that are following them. And then it dries up pretty fast. There's people that are spending a lot of money. Bloomberg's team spent a fortune on Facebook. I know Biden's team is starting to spend a fortune on Facebook. But it's very marketing-centric. It doesn't engage people.
If you were going to advise someone in that world about what to change, what would you say?
Tell better stories. Like, actual, don't be afraid to share things that are stories that are local in level, that relate to real issues that are affecting real people, stuff that they want to share and be seen sharing with their friends and their families and their communities. And don't be afraid of the negative comments that are going to come back from that. If you share something that's meaningful, you will upset someone and you're going to have that conversation with them. And don't be afraid of having the conversation.
Very fascinating and really an honor to talk to you today about what you've been up to. Anything else you want to say?
Thank you for having me on and thank you for having all of these interviews. It's I love listening to them all, both the history that people bring to the efforts, what drives their passion, but just, you know, I think the fact that you're out collecting these stories is so important because it provides a benchmark or a point in time to see what people are thinking and what they're doing. And so much of the work that a lot of us do is isolated. And even though we're connected, we're not as connected as we could be. And you're serving as a connector, so I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much. That was Sean Kemp and Action Sprout. He's at actionsprout.com. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with a great Battlefield podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.